Let's start. Welcome to the Quanto IR teleconference. So today the idea was that I will present a proposal for a design of DOL, which will be an answer to the Quanto IR RFP. But before that, let me ask whether there are any other issues. One issue was the OMG technical meeting in March. Anything else? Okay, so concerning the March meeting, Elisa Kendall asks who or how many of us would be there and whether we would like to share a room with API for KB.
I also got an email from Corey.
Yeah.
Who wants to organize something during that week. I can't find the email right now, but did you get a discount?
Corey. Let me see. I got some emails from Corey, but I'm not sure.
I think he's writing something on Sunday.
Excuse me?
I think he's arranging something on Sunday.
Yeah, Sunday 23rd, March 23rd.
That's
proposed architecture ecosystem SIG meeting. Yeah. You mean this? Javier, did you mean this meeting?
Yes.
Okay.
So that's for the AE-SIG submission team, which, you know, might or might not be beneficial to interact with. But he was specifically addressing the submitters to that.
I mean, he mentioned Quanto IOP in his email, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. I mean, he's saying that we as a submission team have a lot to discuss, including the fact that Quanto IOP has been submitted, but it doesn't look like an invitation. Let me see if I read the whole thing. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure anyone from Quanto IOP is welcome and even useful to them because they're trying to work out their relation, but it's an invitation to the submitters. I think the fact that he had to send it to the whole ADTF indicates he doesn't have anything.
Okay, so the question would be who of this group plans to go to Western Virginia in March 24th to 28th. That's the meeting, basically. So Fabian and I have discussed whether we should at least be represented there with one person from Quanto IOP. And
you mean at the AE-SIG meeting? Yeah, I guess.
No, not just AE-SIG, but the meeting at all. So I consider more relevant an email from Elisa Kendall. Where she asks whether we would be actually.
My understanding is, see, you don't have anything official you need to do at OMG. However, often.
Yeah.
In fact, very often, the submission teams ask for rooms, which are technically private meetings among the submission teams, but the OMG will provide the rooms. And then the submission team does its work at the meeting since everyone's there anyway.
Yeah.
But you know, it's not required for a submission team to meet. So it's a matter of convenience.
Okay, so they won't be disappointed if we don't show up there at all, but prepare the submission at the teleconferences.
Yes, I mean, no one would be expecting necessarily, well, I mean, submission teams often do, but for example, I know that at least in my appreciate discussion, who knows? I mean, but it's for their benefit. It's not something you have to do. I'm realizing that the AEC meeting is actually not a submitters meeting, although he's probably going to use it like that. I think he's attempted to have a wider discussion in that special interest group about these topics. He would probably be happy to have Honto IF people come there and talk about the relationship to sense and these AE6 topics generally, but, you know, it's not a required participation.
So, in short, the goodwill would be a sign of goodwill, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
For us not only to attend the discussions which we have here on Honto IF, but the show interest in related efforts at the OMG meeting and be part of the social fabric.
Right, right.
Part of
the socialization of your work, so that, you know, it's in addition to the formal presentations at the ADTF that you might have these meetings and have the discussion go on outside of the submission team just to explain to people what you're doing and maybe make additional contacts and so on. So it's a good idea. It's just not absolutely mandatory in terms of the OMG process.
So we also have discussed whether we could visit this Virginia meeting, but the next one in Boston was a Shoesage in June instead.
Michael here, just joining. Sorry, Mike.
Uh-huh. Hi, Michael.
Hello.
We're just discussing about the OMG technical meetings and whether someone of Honto IF would be there. And I've discussed this with Fabian yesterday, and the question was we could be there at the March or at the June meeting. And Fabian has to go to Washington in summer anyway, so it could be combined. He could combine it with a visit in Boston in June.
Well, wait a minute. That hasn't been settled yet that I go.
Yeah, okay.
So, from that perspective, it may help going in March, then I can make clear, can try to settle the trip to U.S. in the summer. Can that, if I'm in Washington anyhow, then I can go from there to Boston. That's not at all. That's not very far. So,
yeah.
Relatively.
What's the date in June?
16th to 20th. And in March is 24th to 28th.
Michael, are you going to attend either of these meetings?
So the problem is in June, there's the ISO meeting in China, June 5th and 6th. I'm not sure if I'd be back in time for that. March is a bit of a problem with lecturing and everything. But Conrad, I just noticed in the chat, Conrad's saying it's we don't really have a presentation kind of on the agenda. So it sounds like the March meeting would not be perhaps as important as the June meeting.
Is June the official submission?
The initial submission will be in December, so I'm not sure whether the June meeting would be more important than the March meeting. Probably they're equally important or not important.
Yeah.
Well, in terms of OMG process, you're only required against them in December. But like Sergeant's saying, it's a matter of socialization. If you feel like the submitters meeting, submitters often meet there. If you wanted to talk with the AEC people in general, it's just schmoozing. You can always do that between initial and revised.
Well, I mean, my impression is that we should show up there before the meeting in December, because I had the feeling that during during the December meeting that I attended, that the schmoozing part is rather important. Otherwise, you don't get this stuff through your otherwise. So, you know, talking to people and having good personal relationships certainly helps to get their support for the standard, which content they only partially understand. So, I think it would be a very poor idea to not show up for a year and then come and say, here's our proposal, please take it. But that would be bad.
Okay, so
we should either go to the December, to the March, or to the, I should say there's another one in September. Okay, well, I think we should aim at least for one, maybe even better would be two to go there.
Well, watch out. The September meeting's getting close to voice.
Yeah, that's true.
But it's not overlapping, yeah? Voice.
When is...
It's 22nd, 25th. It's right after.
Yeah.
Voice is right after.
Yeah, right after.
And the summer school?
Oh, yeah, it was the beach with summer school.
Don't put the dates here.
If someone could capture those dates on the chat, it would provide an easy reference.
So on the web page, it says 22nd to 25th, all events. There's no summer school.
No, one week before FOIS is the summer school.
Ah, yeah, okay.
So, yeah, so the September meeting would overlap with the summer school.
Okay. Since Oliver already said that that it's crucial for Cohen men to go to the to FOIS in the summer school, I think something along the lines. So that I am booked.
Yeah, but Fabian, you could go in June, possibly if you are anyway there, and then perhaps in March to prepare your stay at NIST.
Yeah.
And Michael.
I could go to Reston, but I'm not a member of OMG. I don't think they'd let me in the meeting.
Oh, I was in Berlin and had not been a member either at that time. So that, and I even gave a talk.
Well,
so they accept guests.
Okay. Well, you can put me down for Reston if it'll help for me to be there. If I don't
But someone has to pay to get in, right?
Yeah, it costs $1,000.
Sorry about that. Never mind.
Costs $1,000 for non-members?
Yeah, you basically pay your membership, and then it's the same price. You pay your membership and the registration. It's the same as non-member registration.
Okay. I think for members it's $100 discount or something.
Oh,
like
okay.
That.
Yeah.
Well, they give a discount if you stay at the hotel that the conference is at, because they have a deal with the hotel. They give you a discount if you register early, which means before the end of next week, they also give you a discount if you're a member. If you have all three of these, it comes down to $500.
Ah, okay, great.
I think the non-members, if you were a non-member, but you had the other two, I think it's like $750. That's a check.
So, and Michael, you cannot come to the June meeting. What was with March? I didn't get that.
Well, with March, I could potentially make it. Let's see, the exact dates here, 24th to 28th. It's just a, let's see, the teaching.
I mean, yeah,
you know, that kind of takes out a whole week of my lectures. That's the problem there.
So it's actually non-members, it would be $600 if you registered early and stay at the hotel. Most of the discount, more than half the discount is just staying at the hotel.
Oh,
okay. You have to deal with the hotel. So it's $600 for if you don't get that OMG member discount.
Maybe you can't
you have
that
to register
like, yeah.
by the end of next week. And also there's a hotel deadline, I think, for, you know, getting onto their block. Although, maybe that doesn't matter if you're on the block, but you want to get on the block because it's cheaper.
Okay, so then there is a certain potential that Michael and Fabian could be at the March meeting, but then I would suggest that we clarify the details offline.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. Yeah, great. Then I can tell Elisa that maybe a few people are coming and there won't be the need for a larger room, probably. Yeah. Okay, great. So then a small thing to report, a letter of intent. So Fraunhofer Focus has sent a letter of intent and they're a platform member. So that's very important that we are supported by a platform member. Elisa Kendall also is preparing to submit a letter of intent. And they're also a platform member. And, yeah, University of Magdeburg, I will also prepare one. And it's a university member. And I think Michael Toronto is also a university member.
Correct.
Yeah, so you could also send a letter.
Well, the letters of intent are for people who are or organizations that are going to they're going to produce a piece of software. So, for example, NIST doesn't file them, except in rare cases if we can partner with some open source people. Because the letter of intent will basically you're stating your intent to produce a product based on it.
Aha. I mean, we are producing software at Magdeburg.
I think open source counts. I mean, it doesn't necessarily need to be commercial, I don't think.
Oh, yeah, so in that case, we could also say the same thing. Yeah.
You'll see that. You should read the wording to see if, the details of it and whether you actually are going to do with it. That's between us. They never actually check that you do what it says. But.
Okay, so, we need to clarify whether you really produce commercial software or open source suffices. So then we have four letters of intent. And we had a list, I think last time. So I have sent out some requests, got no answer yet, except Tara has answered, with some suggestions, basically. Let me see.
Yeah, what I sent was a list of the people who have submitted LOIs for API 4KB, and I thought there was a potential for overlap there, that someone who implements API for KB might also implement some part of onto IOP, so it's worth checking.
So you mean the whole list here, 88 solutions, adaptive, and so on?
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Then maybe I post this onto the chat.
Yeah. Another source that I tracked down was my contact with Red Hat and JBoss, who said they don't sign LOIs themselves because they don't have the money to fund it, but they're interested in partnering so they could basically lend their name as a credibility to it if someone from the community was going to implement something that might help out. And it would, naturally, they would want it to be connected to their product, their JBoss product as well.
Ah, JBoss, yeah.
So the thing to look for is,
I was just going to say the contact there is Mark Proctor, if you know of him.
No.
Okay.
Another thing to look for is just supporters who are not submitters. That people who are LOI are the submitters. And then submissions often have a list of people who are not submitters in the sense of submitting an LOI, that they LOI, but that they support the work. And so on the submission page, often you see submitters and then a list, and then on the cover page you see supporters and then a list. And the supporters, they eventually disappear in the actual standard that the submitters are taken and given copyright, and then the supporters are eventually removed. But the document that goes around for vote will have the supporter list on it. So that's another good thing about, you know, socializing it, is you can gather these supporters for the document.
So that might be also a good reason to travel to Preston, because it's still before the deadline for LOIs, which is in May. Okay.
You technically only need one LOI, but it looks good in terms if you have more, because then the people voting on it see support for it and the likelihood of implementation and so on.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. Currently we have basically four that we can expect, but probably to get some more would be nice.
Does NIST support?
Yeah, we would support, but that doesn't require a letter. That just, you know, we say to the submission team, or if we're on the submission team, we just say we'd like to be put as listed as supporters on the document. And, you know, when you give presentations and so on, the advantage is, well, people get interested or they might like it, and then they might offer to support it, or you can solicit that. There's often many more supporters than there are LOIers, because there's lots of users who don't produce products, or there's companies that produce products, but they're not going to do it right away. So you can often gather a long list of supporters.
Do supporters need to be OMG members?
No, because they are not. Putting that list on your submission document has no official status. It's just telling readers that it's more than just the submitters that are interested in it. More than just the LOIers that are interested in it.
Okay, so since OntoIOP will basically be the engine or part of the engine of OntoHub, and hopefully by the time of the submission we will have some users for OntoHub, that would be a good place to look for people who could be called supporters because they're using some software which is based on OntoHub.
Those guys are also typically ones that you can ask to file the business committee questionnaire, which is the one that the board needs to actually finally approve everything. They need at least one answer to that questionnaire that says, I'm going to implement it. And then it doesn't hurt to have people file answers to the questionnaire saying that I'm going to use it, that they're going to use it. So, you know, that's another way that supporters can help.
So that's a questionnaire about the implementations, yeah?
Yeah, way at the end of the process. It's called the Business Committee, the BCQ, the Business Committee Questionnaire. But you'll get a notification about that. Jürgen will request them after the adoption votes and then after the finalization.
Okay, good. So then we will keep contacting both supporters and LOI submitters, and so we can ask for both LOI submission, and if they don't want to do that, then to be a supporter. And later on, also to be some tester of the software and answer this business committee questionnaire. Great. Okay, so if there is nothing left for this point, then I suggest to proceed to the next point, which would be my talk on DOL. Okay. So at the start of the chat, you have a URL for the slides, and I also sent them on the mailing list. So, yeah, let's look at the slides. So, I start. Yeah.
So, what's the context for the slides again, Phil? Sorry, I missed the beginning of the meeting.
The slides are presenting the current design of DOL.
Ah, okay.
And DOL will be the central submission that we prepare for onto IOP for the RFP.
Okay.
Okay. So, slide 2 starts with motivation. I will go rather quickly through the initial slides because we have seen this already, and this is more for basically providing the context. So we have that OntoIOP is about interoperability for the modeling level, the specification level, and the modeling domain, the specification domain, and the knowledge engineering domain. And we have ontologies, specifications, and models, all formal, and they are basically the subject of OntoIOP. And ontology, specifications, and models will be henceforth abbreviated as OSMs. And you could also view them as logical theories. Okay, slide 4. We have, that's basically from the RFP presentation. We have, in these different fields, we have different use cases. For example, ontology use case would be OMGs. The time vocabulary, which is actually formulated in different languages, and there are interoperability questions. Then slide five, the same is in the specification world. You have different notions of refinement, or you have basically the same notion of refinement, but that can be instantiated to different formalisms. Refinement proceeds from software requirements to a specific design to code, and there is a change of formalism during the development often. And slide 6, also in the UML world, you have dozens of different kinds of diagrams, and the question is, are they consistent with each other? Slide 7, that shows that there are many different logics used for ontologies, and there are some relations between these logics, translations. Slide 8, we also have some logic graph in the specification world that's taken here from the heterogeneous tool set. And slide 9 shows some UML languages that are floating around, some UML diagrams that are used in the modeling community. And there's also the question what consistency means among these different diagrams. Slide 10. There's also a diversity of operations and relations among OSMs, so at the kind of structuring level, like you have structuring of specifications, like union, translating, hiding, refinement between specifications, matching and alignment between ontologies, module extraction, approximation in some less expressive language, database access, and distributed OSMs. Slide 11. So, also IOP, okay. The goal is slide 12, to have not yet an OSM, not yet another OSM language, but a meta language covering this diversity. Slide 13. Therefore, we have onto IOP, which has been an ISO initiative, but now is OMG. Slide 14. That's an excerpt of the requirements that are in the RFP. So we should provide a meta language, logically heterogeneous, modular, with links and combinations. We should provide an abstract syntax, preferably as a MOF or SMOF model, a concrete syntax, a formal semantic, with criteria for logics to conform with onto IOP. And we should be logic agnostic, so applied to a specific logic. Slide 15. So that was all very quick, some initial motivation.
So can I just ask a question about where slide 9 came from or where I could find out more about it?
Slide 9, this is joint work with Alexander Knapp and Holger Schlingloff. Alexander has worked on these different UML diagrams and provided them with a formal semantics, which is kind of prerequisite for really integrating this with onto IOP. And so I can send you some.
Yeah, if you could put the reference in the chat or send me something, I'd be interested.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, I can send you some paper. Okay, so then slide 16. Now, DOL will be one specific answer to the RFP. DOL also has been already been prepared in the ISO group, but now it's continued as an answer to the RFP. DOL is based on some graph of logics formalized as institutions and logic translations formalized as institution morphisms or comorphisms, and it has a semantics both model level and theory level, so that it an OSM denotes a logical theory or a class of models. I won't show the semantics today, but I have worked out some details of the semantics. Slide 17. Related work is structured specifications and their semantics. There is a lot of work in the specification community, for example, CLEAR, ASL, or CASL. Heterogeneous specification like Headcastle, which is a precursor of DOL, and modular ontologies, the VOMO workshop series, for example, a workshop on modular ontologies. Now slide 18. Now we come to the heart of the matter. So it all consists basically of two parts. The first part is modular and heterogeneous OSMs. So that basically takes basic OSMs, which is the first item here, which are basically written in some ontology specification or modeling language. And then we have certain meta operations on these. We can have references to named OSMs, so we can store OSMs under certain identifiers or URLs. We can extend OSMs, we can unite them, we can translate them, so we name symbols. We have reductions, which means we restrict things to an export interface. We have approximations, module extractions, minimization, maximization, combination, and ridges. And all of these are either flattenable or elusive, so that's indicated in bracket. And so if some component is elusive, the whole OSM is also elusive, so only OSMs with flattenable components can be flattenable. Terry asked whether flattenable means that there is a linear representation. That's true. So a flattenable OSM basically can be equivalently transformed to a flat logical theory, just a signature in some set of axioms, whereas the elusive OSMs cannot be flattened. And then the second part of DOL is OSM declarations and relations. That's based on the first part, but it's basically doing something or putting something on the top. The first thing is we can give a name to an OSM, which is called an OSM definition. Or say you can find this OSM under a specific URL. We have interpretations of theories, equivalences of OSM, modular relations, and alignments. So these are all binary relations between OSMs, and we can declare them, and there can be a correctness criterion, for example, for interpretations. We have one. So these declarations and relations take OSMs and relate them somehow. So, slide 19. So we start with the first part, modular and heterogeneous OSMs. Slide 20. So a basic OSM. So it's written in some OSM language from the logic graph. The logic graph is a parameter of the whole language, so it can be later extended, and you can also take different logic graphs, say one ontology logic graph, one specification logic graph, and one modeling logic graph. But the DOL language doesn't need any change. So the semantics of these basic OSMs is inherited from the respective OSM language. That's quite important. So that's not saying you can translate everything into our language X and then you're happy. You don't need to translate. You can directly use things as they are. For example, here's an OWL ontology in Mencius syntax or a common logic ontology in Cliff syntax. And they have the semantics as defined in the OWL standard or the OSM standard. Okay. Then slide 21, we can have extensions. The simplest form of extension is O1, then O2, where O1 is an OSM and O2 is just a list of symbols and axioms, basically a basic OSM in some language, which intuitively means that we extend O1, which may be complex in structure, by some new stuff. And the new stuff is not complex in structure, it's just simple. At the bottom you see some example in our class person and class female we have, and then we extend it with class woman, which is equivalent to person and female. Now this extension has a special property, namely it's definitional. So you can see this because class woman is now in essence defined to be the intersection of person and female. So there is no freedom in interpreting woman once you have fixed the interpretation of person and female. And that's called a definitional extension. On the fourth bullet, it's explained a definitional extension means that each model of O1 has a unique expansion to the model of the whole extension O1, then O2. You can also have weaker forms like conservative extensions, that model conservative extension or consequence conservative extension. That letter basically means that the extension does not prove more than the ontology O1 itself for languages in this, for sentences in the language of O1. That's the classical notion of conservativity. We also have an implied extension, which is like M bonds, but the signature must not be extended. That basically means that the extension has the same model class and the same signature as O1 itself. So that it can be used for specifying intended consequences of an OSM. So you can say, here are 5 sentences that should be a logical consequence of my OSM. That's quite important also for documentation purposes. Slide 22. We have references to named OSMs. You just write one URL or IRI more generally, and then you can refer to an OSM stored under this URL. And you need maybe use prefixing or, these are these queries for abbreviating URLs in a short way, like you see here on the slide.
So tell on the previous slide, 21, what's an extension as opposed to an extension?
What's an extension?
No, what is an expansion as opposed to an extension?
Okay. An extension is an extension of an OSM by some new stuff. And an expansion is an expansion of a model. So you have a model of the smaller OSM, and then you can expand it to a model of the extension.
Okay. So the expansion has to do with the signature. So you basically keep the interpretations of all the relations, et cetera, fixed, and all you're doing is expanding the language, expanding the signature with some new relation name. So, say with this example, person and female, you would simply be, you wouldn't be changing the extension of person or female, that would stay the same. What you're doing is you're expanding the signature, you're adding a new class called woman, and the definition determines what the who are the instances of woman, but all you're doing is expanding the language. An extension would mean you could also potentially be adding new elements and new tuples into the relations.
On this slide I use it slightly differently. An extension is in the syntax, so you extend an OSM or a logical theory, and an expansion is always for the models. So you have a specific model, So in the sense of model theory, so an interpretation.
Oh, so extension here, you're kind of, extension is an extension of a theory, not extension of a model. Okay.
Yeah.
But expansion, you're still using in the model theoretic sense, expanding the theory.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, maybe I should clarify this on the slide, so.
Well, the word extension, I mean, is heavily overloaded in logic. And there's at least three different ways of using it, if not more. So, yeah.
Well, fortunately, the word extension at LMG is used syntactically.
Mm. Extension.
Yeah, at LMG, to extend a language means to expand its syntax.
Yeah, but extension is also used syntactically here, so there is no conflict.
Right. That's what I was saying.
Well,
no, but
what Conrad said is extending a language.
Yeah.
Your extent here is a theory.
Yeah.
Ontology. So, it's not exactly the same. It's similar.
Yeah, when you say syntactic, you know, yeah, so there's the signature, which is the expansion. Extension of a theory means adding, new sentences to the theory.
Oh, I
see. Thanks.
No, I'm confused. That's not how it's used here, though. Michael, what you just said?
Well, okay, yeah. So it's kind of both, because he says extension by new symbols and axioms. So it's kind of both senses.
Mm. Well, by symbols, do you mean new names?
Yes.
The signature is being extended.
But not necessarily like new reserved words, like adding an exclusive or connective to the common logic language. Would that also fit under this kind of extension?
Normally not, no. That would only be new symbols, but stay within the same logic.
Okay. I have a feeling that's the OMG idea of syntactic extension. Is adding new reserved words or constructions to the language, so that these concepts would be disjoint.
Related somehow.
Yeah, we can worry about. They don't have a precise definition of it anyway. So
mm-hmm.
I just meant to say just generally,
be prepared
when you
for
need to expand the language, it means you're adding new concepts, which are your symbols. Usually relationships between those, you're adding them to an existing set. Or you're specializing some of the concepts so you're adding symbols and some axioms.
And yeah, that's
what you ever considered, like, the effect of extending semantics is. They always think of it in terms of what you're doing to the meta model.
But that would be the relationship they would recognize, specialization, I think. So if you have a model and you create a model which adds more content to the model, more the restrictions or something like that, I think they would call that a specialization, wouldn't they?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that if you leave the symbols alone and just add action to having basically new requirements. So that would be specialization.
Right.
In model think.
Okay, but I think extension of the logic and extension of a theory is different. It's also differentiated in DOL, but it's kind of similar also semantically. So it's not that bad that we call this extension. But if there is another name in the OMG community for this kind of extension and new symbols and axioms, I'm also happy to change the notation, the wording here.
Well, I think the conclusion is, on this slide anyway, you're using it similarly to the way OMG does use the word extension.
Ah, great. So, slide 22, yeah, references to named OSMs, we just had that. that's also standard in OWL, say, if you can do that, or CommLogic. Unions. A union is written O1 and O2 of two standalone OSMs. The difference to extensions is that for extensions, O2 needs to be basic, but O2 can be kind of a fragment. So if you go back to slide 21, then the thing after the then, class woman, equivalent to person and female, is not a valid OWL ontology, because person and female are declared. And protege, for example, would spot an error here. And so this only works because this is an extension of class person and class female. So that means, of course, all the previously declared things are kept. Whereas if you look at the union on page 23, then both are basically standalone OSM. They can be both complex and structured, and basically the semantics is that the signatures and axioms are united while the model classes are intersected. An example from the specification world, if you specify monoid and commutative binary operations, and then combine the two specifications with an AND, you get commutative monoid. So you basically combine the constraints and get something new that inherits both constraints. Slide 24. Translations. So there are two kinds of translations. The first one is written O with sigma, and sigma is a signature morphism, which is basically a map of symbols. So you can rename certain things. For example, in ontology, you could rename person to human being because you find it more appropriate. The second translation is translating something to a different logic. And that's written O with translation rho, where rho is an institution comorphism, so a logic mapping, basically. Here's an example. We start an OWL, define a role or object property as proper part of, which is asymmetric and subproperty of is part of, and then we also want to specify that this is transitive, but this is not possible in OWL. You have to choose. You can either specify it to be asymmetric or transitive, but not both. But what you can do is you translate the whole thing from OWL to CommLogic with a certain logic translation, and then you extend it using then. And then you write the transitivity there in CommLogic. There should be a universal quantifier. Sorry for that. Okay, that's translation. The dual concept is that of reduction. The intuition is there that you restrict your OSM to an export interface that's similar to programming languages, where you have a program module, you have auxiliary operations or methods, and you don't want them to be visible to the user, and you just restrict the module to an export interface. And here the same is that some logical or non-logical symbols are hidden, but in the sense, the semantic effect of the sentences that are hidden is kept. So there are three different forms here. O reveal sigma, which means that you, yeah, sigma is your export interface, and you restrict everything to that export interface. Sigma is a sub-signature of that of O. And then there's O hide sigma, which is throwing away everything that is in sigma. There's an example here at the bottom of the page. This is in Castle. So that's first order logic. Many sorted first order logic. You have a sort of element. You declare operations, zero plus an inverse, and then you have the group axioms stating that this is really a group. And then you hide the inverse operation. And you end up with something where you have just the zero and the plus, but implicitly you always know it's possible to add an inverse such that the inverse axiom holds. So you're really still specifying the class of groups. Finally, we have O hide along mu, where mu is an institution morphism. Here you could take, for example, a specification in higher order logic and hide the higher order parts and end up in the first order logic specification. So you forget the higher order component. You could also take a first order theory and hide along a projection, say, to OWL, and throw away all the predicates that have RG greater than 2 and throw away all the function symbols that are not constants and so on. So these are reductions. Related is on slide 26, interpolation. Interpolation is approximating a theory in a subsignature or a substitution. So you have O keep in sigma, which is similar to O reveal sigma, but you can also say O keep in sigma with I, where you say, for example, you want to approximate a common logic theory in OWL. That would be possible with this construct. Duly, you have O forget sigma and O forget sigma with I. Here we have again the group example, and now we forget the inverse operation. So now you might have the question, what is the difference between hiding inverse, which is done on slide 25, and forgetting inverse, which is done on slide 26? The difference is that on slide 25, you have a model class semantics. You really hide the inverse, but you still have the class of models being the groups. On slide 26, the interpolation has a theory level semantics. That is, here you interpolate an axiom which says there exists for each x, there exists a y such that x plus y is zero. So you basically circumscribe the effect of the inverse operation that has been hidden. And that means you have a theory level semantics, not a model level semantics. You can have a theory that interpolates, technically it's a uniform interpolant. The problem with this operation is that these uniform interpolants not always exist. So it should be used with care. And maybe one can say that the hiding is the primary operation, and for proving purposes, one might change this and forget once one has found an interpolant, and otherwise one wouldn't need this interpolation. Slide 27, module extractions are. So that's basically studied a lot in the ontology community. So you write this like O extract C, where C can be a conservativity, either model or a consequence conservativity. Then you have a restriction signature, which is a sub-signature of that of O, with a certain method M. So the standard use case is you have an ontology like SNOMED, which has, I think, more than 100,000 concepts about the medical domain. And now you want to extract a sub module, say, about heart functions and heart diseases, which I'm not sure. Maybe you have only 200 concepts or whatever. But you want to be sure that your sub-ontology of heart functions basically is logically complete. That means your ontology O, the whole SNOMED, must be a conservative extension of the resulting extracted module. And then you can do module extraction. You specify a sub-signature which has, say, some heart components in there. The module extraction method might enlarge the signature because it says, okay, there are other relevant concepts and roles and individuals that are related to this, so I need to enlarge the signature in order to be able to extract the module, and here is my module. For example, you could here take the pizza ontology from Manchester and extract only things about vegetarian pizza, vegetable topping, and Hess topping with the locality method, which is a quite well-known module extraction method. Okay, and then there is a dual construct O remove C sigma with M, where you don't specify the signature that you want to keep, but you specify the symbols that you want to throw out, which, of course, for large ontologies as SNOMED does not make any sense because you would have tens of thousands of things to specify there. But for small ontologies, it might be useful. Okay. Slide 28 now gives an overview because we have basically three different things, extract, forget, and hide, and each of them comes into two flavors, namely whether we specify a signature of those things to keep or of those things to remove. And yeah, these three things have different semantic background, namely conservative extension, uniform interpolation, and model reduct. And they also have different approaches to the semantics. So the first two are theory level, and the third one is model level. And correspondingly, the first two are flattenable, the last thing is elusive, and the signature of the result can be enlarged for the extraction and not be enlarged for the other one. So that probably deserves further examples and clarification where users can actually understand these subtle differences. Maybe we need also some methodology and say you should use it in that way in order to avoid confusion. Okay, then slide 29, minimization in the style of McCarthy's circumscription. That's basically an easy way of integrating non-monotonicity into the meta language without too much trouble that comes normally with monotonic logics. So you have the syntax is O1, and then you have the extension keyword then, and then minimize O2 in curly braces. And this forces all symbols in O2 to be interpreted minimally. Here's an example in OWL. You have a class of blocks. You have two different individuals, B1 and B2. And then you, in the minimized construct, introduce a class abnormal blocks, and only B1 is specified to be abnormal. By minimality, we immediately know that B2 is not abnormal, because we only specify the positive effects here and everything else, that is not specified positively to be abnormal, is not abnormal. Then we extend this with a new class on table, and basically.
I have a question.
Yeah, sure.
You said when you talked about them that the result, the second argument of them needs to be basic. But this looks to me like a complex ontology. I mean, you have O2 is basic, and then you have minimize as an operator on O2. So minimize, or maybe I assume that this means O1, then parenthesis, minimize O2, closing parenthesis.
Yeah,
so,
true.
So in this case, O2 is minimize O2 is not a basic ontology, or is basic defined in a different way than I think?
No, you're right. So basically, I have to revise what I said. If you have an extension, there can be also beyond basic ontologies, there can be minimize and maximize. Alternatively, you could see this as a new construct, then minimize. It's basically, yeah. Maybe we can also find a different keyword for that and avoiding the then here. But I think it's rather natural to have the then here.
Could I just forget about O1 then and just have minimize as a standalone?
Yeah, true. That's also possible. That's also possible.
So then it's clear that minimize is really an operator.
Yeah, it's an operator, and it's an operator that also can occur after then. And it's necessary that it can occur after then, because otherwise you could not really have useful examples like the one I presented. And if you don't have that, then you have to specify the fixed and the varying, and then there's a third type. So there are three different kinds of symbols that you have to specify, and this is done in circumscription, but this is quite esoteric, I would say. And here, using the trick with then, you get this quite naturally. So because you have the first class of symbols are those before the first then. The second class of symbols, which are the minimized things, are, yeah, exactly. You have the fixed, the varying, and the minimized symbols. Okay, and here the fixed symbols would be the ones before the first then. The minimized symbols are those between those inside the minimize construct, and the varying symbols are those after the second then, so with the class on table.
Sorry, the second then?
The second then, yeah. Class on table. Class on table is a varying symbol in circumscription speak. But we don't want to introduce this circumscription speak with this, then it comes out rather naturally integrated in the language. But you're right, then we have to lift the restriction that after then there can be only basic ontologies there, or OSMs, there can also be minimized and maximized.
Okay, well, that was just introducing some new terminology to make this clear. But just to my understanding, I couldn't say, if I would want not use then, but and, or one and then minimize O2, now I would have to rewrite O2 in a way that it makes explicit which part of the signature is minimized and which isn't. Is that what you said?
Yes, but we don't have a syntax for this other than using the then.
Okay.
I have a proposal for a different syntax, which would be used alternatively, where you explicitly specify the varying and the fixed symbols. We could also do that.
Yeah, my question was not really, please don't understand my question as a suggestion for changing it. It was first to understand what is going on, and because I was confused. So, I don't know whether, I expect that it might be useful to just use minimize independently of an extension. I guess you can always minimize, simulate that by starting with the zero, with the empty ontology, and then use the then construction. So,
yeah, that's true. Yeah, but you cannot if you use and, then you have a problem here, because then you would minimize everything in the and ontology, and that's not what you want. You, in this example, you just want to minimize abnormal. And the abnormal and B1 and so on, and not the
from a design perspective, it's a little bit weird to say minimize an operator, which works like any of these other operators in a way, but then because some other syntaxes is missing. It's an operator which only can be usefully used in combination with then. It seems like a half-hearted approach. Either make it an operator which can be used independently, or instead of using then minimize, introduce a new term which is instead of then start. Which is automatically minimizing. You know what I mean? Seems weird to, it's an independent syntactic construct, but it's the way it's working right now. It's really only useful in combination with that.
That's not true, actually. You can also use minimize as a full-blown operator on OSM. You can forget about the then and just say minimize, and then have any complex OSM there. In there, that's also possible.
Okay.
Yeah, I should put this on the slides here. That's true. That's missing.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for this clarifying question. Okay. So, then to new constructs which are useful in the Castle language. Would be similar to minimize. We can have maximize, which is not shown here. But we can also have free and co-free, which is useful for specifying certain data types. For example, if we say bags are basically defined by an operation empty and a union, which is associative, commutative, and has unit empty. Then from algebra, we know that the free such algebra is the algebra of bags over these elements here. And then with this algebraic interpretation, we can specify bags easily. It would be much more complicated to specify bags from the scratch. Similar co-freeness, for example, here you can specify infinite streams by just saying they're the co-free interpretation using a head and tail operation.
What are initial and final interpretations?
Initial means that there is a model homomorphism into any other model, and final means that there is a unique model homomorphism from any other model. So these are technical notions from algebra.
Or Conrad, do you know like Herbrand models and minimal Herbrand models in Prolog?
No, but I get the direction you're going with it. I can look it up.
So I'm not sure whether we should really put this in, but it's quite easy to use it for the specification of data types, and that's nice. So in the specification world, you need a quick way of specifying certain data types, and the ENCODE can be used for that. Christoph, thanks for your detailed comments. I will go through them after the telecom. Okay, so concludes the overview of the OSMs. I'm not sure how exhausted you are. We could also leave the second part for next week, next time, so in 2 weeks. Or should we go on with the declarations and relations?
Given that you have about 30 slides left or something, I think we
you're halfway.
Yeah.
Well, I raised a question in the chat, which we haven't gotten to yet, so maybe we could spend at least a minute or two on that, which was about slide 20.
Uh-huh.
Scrolling back to there. So you show us a snippet of common logic here, which is based on the semantics that are in the published common logic standard. I don't think it means what you think it means. So it's expressed in CLIF, and CLIF has this one universe semantics, and so therefore your a conclusion from your pre-order is that the entity LE satisfies that relation. Okay, so this axiom would follow. And as you may be aware, we're working in the revision on trying to make the semantics such that you could exclude the LE, the thing named as LE, from your domain of discourse, so it would not be part of what's quantified over, but it were somewhat under fire from certain directions on that regard. And it would be helpful for those of us who are trying to fight that fight to understand how this sort of text really fits in with Dole. Is it really critical, for example, to be able to translate from other languages into these kinds of common logic texts?
So essentially, yeah, like Haru, I think what you're also saying is that the way that Dole is considering the kind of the importation of different logics, it can be used as a test case for Dole, but it can also be used as examples for how common logic is intended to be used. And this would be an example of where you would need to have some way of declaring what is in your discourse and what's out of your discourse. It kind of highlights some of the aspects of common logic as well.
Right. I mean, there are people in the telecon who are saying, well, nobody ever does that.
Yeah.
And it would be nice to have concrete examples to say, yes, people do.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, surely this example has been written assuming that the LE cannot be substituted for X, but you're right, in the CL semantics it can be.
Right, so the issue is, like all over Calori as well, that Cliff, the official semantics of Cliff is that it's what was called an unsegregated dialect. And so you quantify over all the relations. All the relations are in your universe of discourse. And so, whereas most of the applications we've been looking at, Calori and examples like this, do not have that assumption of being unsegregated. So there's this weird situation where people are kind of looking the other way for now, but that really is a use case for why there has to be this way of distinguishing which relations you want to be in discourse and which ones you don't want to be in discourse.
Right. But I think in order to strongly make the case, we have to go beyond this definition of pre-order, which is, seems somewhat in the realm of pure mathematics, and explain how that would be used in a situation that would matter to, I'll put in quotes, real people who want to talk about things in the real world.
Any example from a time ontology, for example, could just use these axioms, because most of the orderings on time are partial, semi-linear orderings, etc. So using something like that would be good.
So in the daytime vocabulary, would this then be appearing?
Yes, I believe so, yeah.
Here you can go to slide 24. On slide 24, you have a combination of OWL and common logic. And probably what you want here is that you extend your... So that's a common situation. There are many OWL ontologies that have implicit first-order axioms extra first-order axioms in the comments, in the annotation. And it would be good also for the ability to apply reasoning tools to make these first-order annotations formal. Currently, they are informal comments. And if you want to make them formal, you have to use a construct like this on page 24. You start with some OWL translated to common logic, and then you extend it with some common logic sentence. Now, OWL is basically, from the common logic point of view, segregated. So, and then you want to kind of keep it segregated. You don't want that now is proper part of suddenly becomes a new individual in your models, and you want to keep it out of your models. And that would be a use case advocating this or being in favor of this possibility of declaring segregated symbols somehow. But in general, I would say from the meta-language point of view, DOL is agnostic here. So DOL can live with both decisions because it doesn't say anything about the involved languages, except that they have to behave like logic, which is satisfying very mild conditions.
Okay.
That's right, actually. Because this example on slide 24 could have gone a different way, where proper part of was quantified over, and you just say transitive proper part of, where transitive is a relation on relations, a class of relations.
Mm-hmm.
Well, people might not want that, because then this proper part of is an additional individual in their ontology. And that's not conforming to what is usually in the OWL semantic.
No, that would just be an alternative. Like saying if DOL is agnostic, then that would also be a possibility to document in that way.
Yeah, that's true.
All right. So common logic going in that direction would not break DOL, is what I hear you saying.
Right.
Okay.
Another point is that Dole has these construct references to named OSMs and extending OSMs with new stuff and so on. So it would be more compatible with Dole if Common Logic actually followed this proposal by Ed Barkmeyer and John Soa to make the imports behave like OWL imports. So they are basically built on top of the OWL language somehow and not interfere directly with the OWL language construct.
Mm. No, but see, then you really do want to have Dole to be agnostic about what any particular language does.
Yeah, sure, but then if Common Logic would treat the imports in the way OWL does, then you could map Common Logic imports to OWL imports, and there would be a 1-1 correspondence. If OWL would treat imports in a different way, then you would have to treat OWL theories with imports as kind of unstructured basic theories where you cannot look inside the structuring from a Dole point of view. So the structuring then that is inherently there in the imports, but it would be only visible to Common Logic, but not to Dole.
Yeah, yes. I don't really see that. Why that'd be a problem.
Okay, so I can prepare some slides for next time and then...
Because the complications that arise from imports in something like Common Logic arise because of the interaction between the ability to have like domain restrictions, et cetera. In a lot of cases that are being, you know, kind of used, you don't get that interaction too much. I could see maybe in certain cases there would be some Common Logic ontologies that using imports that would be difficult to translate into OWL, but going the other way around, I don't see what the problem would be.
Yeah, Common Logic is also wanting to stay agnostic with respect to the network, so not to adopt or not to assume that importation is happening over the internet. And so there are certain features of the titling, explicit titling, where you associate titles with texts is put in to make that happen.
Yeah, so if you had some other examples, that'd be great. Oh, are we finished?
Hello?
We lost Till.
Till? No, he still seems to be on the call.
Sorry, yeah. I muted myself locally.
Yeah.
Sorry. I suggest that we stop now because we have really reached the end of the time and meet again in 2 weeks.
Okay.
Okay, so... That's the, what's the date?
The 11th.
Okay.
No, the 12th.
The 12th, sorry, 12th.
Okay. So, see you on the 12th, and thanks for the lively discussion today.
Goodbye. Okay.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.